We open chapter 4 tonight in the Yoga of Divine Love. It came in the 15th July 1918 issue of the Arya, which, as we've noted, is a series that Sri Aurobindo never returned to and did not edit again. Sri Aurobindo will make a few references as we move through this to texts simply by allusion. Sometimes he refers to the Bhagavad Gita, sometimes he is drawing material from the Narada Bhakti Sutra, so far as we can see it, although he actually preferred the Shandilya Bhakti Sutras. Sri Aurobindo is regarded as a great jnani, a great knower of God. He was not demonstrative, yet the thing that brought him into the full embrace of a yoga that aims at reuniting the cosmos with the divine is love. His love for the Supreme is what guided him and raised him to light, which instilled in him the power to assiduously practice a yoga that seems to have no terminus. So the way of devotion, the title of this chapter, is a way of rendering bhakti yoga, the yoga that leads to connection to the divine, not simply the heart, but the whole of the being. We'll see how he makes it integral. Bhakti in itself is as wide as the heart yearning of the soul for the divine, and as simple and straightforward as love and desire going straight towards their object. It cannot, therefore, be fixed down to any systematic method, cannot found itself on a psychological science like the Raja Yoga, or a psychophysical like the Hatha Yoga, or start from a definite intellectual process like the ordinary method of the Jnana Yoga. It may employ various means or supports, and man, having in him a tendency towards order, process, and system, may try to methodize his resort to these auxiliaries. But to give an account of their variations, one would have to review almost all man's numberless religions upon their side of inner approach to the deity. Really, however, the more intimate yoga of bhakti resolves itself simply into these four movements. The desire of the soul when it turns towards God and the straining of its emotion towards him. The pain of love and the divine return of love. The delight of love possessed and the play of that delight, and the eternal enjoyment of the divine lover, which is the heart of celestial bliss. You can see this echoed easily in the Narada Bhakti Sutras in the 6th verse. So, to rephrase it, aspiration, a return to and of love, a delight of possession, and finally, the ananda of the divine lover. These are things that are at once too simple and too profound for methodizing or for analysis. One can at best only say, here are these four successive elements, steps, if we may so call them, of the siddhi, the fulfillment. And here are largely some of the means which it uses. And here again are some of the aspects and experiences of the sadhana of devotion. Sadhana, a discipline, but from the root sad, to go straight. It is a path that leads you straight towards the object. That is why it is a sadhana. We need only trace broadly the general line they follow before we turn to consider how the way of devotion enters into a synthetic and integral yoga, what place it takes there, and how its principle affects the other principles of divine living. All yoga is a turning of the human mind and the human soul, not yet divine in realization, but feeling the divine impulse and attraction in it towards that by which it finds its greater being. So essentially, in our essence, we have innate divinity, but the essence is made real through the practice of yoga. The contact gives it a form and life. Without that rasa inside, without that captured form, essence is out of time and out of space. To make it meaningful, we have to make it vibrant in our being here. Emotionally, the first form which this turning takes must be that of adoration. In ordinary religion, this adoration wears the form of external worship, puja, and that again develops a most external form of ceremonial worship. This element is ordinarily necessary because the mass of men live in their physical minds, cannot realize anything except by the force of a physical symbol, and cannot feel that they are living anything except by the force of a physical action. We might apply here the tantric gradation of sadhana, which makes the way of the pashu, the herd, the animal or physical being, the lowest stage of its discipline, and say that the purely or predominantly ceremonial adoration is the first step of this lowest part of the way. So in the tantra, there's the way for the beginner of the pashu, there's the way of the hero, the vira, and there's the way of the one who is godlike, deva. So isn't it appropriate that we progress from the one to the other in our internal growth? That we accept the beginning, we accept the animal form in which we live and raise it, add luster to it, sublimate, sublate. It is evident that even real religion, and yoga is something more than religion, only begins when this quite outward worship corresponds to something really felt within the mind, some genuine submission, awe, or spiritual aspiration, to which it becomes an aid, an outward expression, and also a sort of periodical or constant reminder, helping to draw back the mind to it from the preoccupations of ordinary life. But so long as it is only an idea of the Godhead to which one renders reverence or homage, we have not yet got to the beginning of yoga. The aim of yoga being union Its beginning must always be a seeking after the divine, a longing after some kind of touch, closeness, or possession. Again, back to the root meaning of bhakti, devotion, which is bhaj, to connect, to contact, to share, to have portion with. Narada Bhakti Sutras, verse 2. When this comes on us, the adoration becomes always primarily an inner worship. We begin to make ourselves a temple of the divine, our thoughts and feelings, a constant prayer of aspiration and seeking, our whole life an external service and worship. Of course, Sri Aurobindo would write about this beautifully, movingly, in his little book, The Mother. And he would make it evident in the whole of his life. It is as this change, this new soul tendency grows, that the religion of the devotee becomes a yoga, a growing contact and union. It does not follow that the outward worship will necessarily be dispensed with, but it will increasingly become only a physical expression or outflowing of the inner devotion and adoration, the wave of the soul throwing itself out in speech and symbolic act. So, yoga means, at the very least, contact and communion. Sri Aurobindo sees this in terms of its inner elements, excusing, if unnecessary, the outer. The outer is welcome so long as it expresses truly the vibration of the inner. So to marry the two is the quest of the seeker. Adoration, before it turns into an element of the deeper yoga of devotion, a petal of the flower of love, its homage and self-uplifting to its sun, must bring with it, if it is profound, an increasing consecration of the being to the divine who is adored. Consecration, from the Latin, to make sacred. And what is it to be aware of the divine? It's to be in tune with, to be aligned with, to permit no other influence. And one element of this consecration must be a self-purifying so as to become fit for the divine contact or for the entrance of the divine into the temple of our inner being or for his self-revelation in the shrine of the heart. Narada Bhakti Sutras, verse 7. This purifying may be ethical in its character, but it will not be merely the moralist seeking for the right and blameless action, or even when once we reach the stage of yoga, an obedience to the law of God as revealed in formal religion. But it will be a throwing away, catharsis, of all that conflicts, whether with the idea of the divine in himself or of the divine in ourselves. In the former case, it becomes an habit of feeling and outer act, an imitation of the divine. In the latter, a growing into his likeness in our nature. What inner adoration is to ceremonial worship, this growing into the divine likeness is to the outward ethical life. It culminates in a sort of liberation by likeness to the divine, a liberation from our lower nature and a change into the divine nature. So his notes as sadrishya mukti. Liberation through likeness in character and nature. So in a sense, we become godlike. We become like the divine. In the Tantra, you'll know that what in thunderation? Manjit, let me ask a question. Raise your hand if you can hear me. Very good. We'll try to go forward. Consecration becomes, in its fullness, a devoting of all our being to the divine. Narada Bhakti Sutra number 8. Therefore also of all our thoughts and our works. Well, there are so many verses in the Gita which say the same thing. We've drawn attention to them, and we will so again in just a few sentences. Here, the yoga takes into itself the essential elements of the yoga of works and the yoga of knowledge, but in its own manner, with its own peculiar spirit. So, in other words, the yoga of love will want to dynamize itself. The yoga of love will want to know that whom it adores. It is a sacrifice of life and works to the divine, but a sacrifice of love more than a tuning of the will to the divine will. The bhakta offers up his life and all that he is and all that he has and all that he does to the divine. This surrender may take the ascetic form as when he leaves the ordinary life of men and devotes his days solely to prayer and praise and worship, or to ecstatic meditation, gives up his personal possessions and becomes the monk or the mendicant whose one and only possession is the divine, gives up all actions in life except those only which help or belong to the communion with the divine and communion with other devotees, or at most keeps the doing from the secure fortress of the ascetic life of those services to men, which seem peculiarly the outflowing of the divine nature of love, compassion, and good. Yes, there is renunciation possible in the realm of the yoga of love. Sri Aurobindo does not prefer it, and he continues. But there is the wider consecration proper to any integral yoga, which accepting the fullness of life and the world in its entirety as the play of the divine, offers up the whole being into his possession. It is a holding of all one is and has as belonging to him only and not to ourselves, and a doing of all works as an offering to him. By this comes the complete active consecration of both the inner and the outer life, the unmutilated self-giving. No chopping up our nature into parts. In Narada Bhakti Sutras, the 19th sutra says in English, The essential character of bhakti is the consecration of all activities by complete surrender to him. Sri Aurobindo has captured it in his own language. And also in his rendering of a section in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 12th chapter, verses 14 to 20. And if you'll permit me, I'll read those in translation, how he rendered them. He said, I have not translated, I have rendered the Gita. He who has no egoism, no I-ness and my-ness, who has friendship and pity for all beings and hate for no living thing, who has a tranquil equality to pleasure and pain, and is patient and forgiving, he who has a desireless content, the steadfast control of self, and the firm, unshakable will and resolution of the yogin, and a love and devotion which gives up the whole mind and reason to me, he is dear to me. He by whom the world is not afflicted or troubled, who also is not afflicted or troubled by the world, who is freed from the troubled, agitated lower nature, and from its waves of joy and fear and anxiety and resentment, he is dear to me. He who desires nothing is pure, skillful in all actions, indifferent to whatever comes, not pained or afflicted by any result or happening, who has given up all initiative of action, who has offered it, he, my devotee, is dear to me. He who neither desires the pleasant and rejoices at its touch, nor abhors the unpleasant and sorrows at its touch, who has abolished the distinction between fortunate and unfortunate happenings, because his devotion receives all things equally as good from the hands of the eternal lover and master, he is dear to me. Equal to friend and enemy, equal to honor and insult, pleasure and pain, praise and blame, grief and happiness, heat and cold, to all that troubles with opposite affections the normal nature, silent, content, and well satisfied with anything and everything, not attached to person or thing, place or home, firm in mind because it is constantly seated in the highest self and fixed forever on the one divine object of his love and adoration, that man is dear to me. But exceedingly dear to me are those devotees who make me, the Purushottama, their one supreme aim, and follow out with a perfect faith and exactitude the immortalizing dharma described in this teaching. I'll read one more small section. This is from an earlier chapter, the close of the ninth in the Gita, Shloka 34. Become my-minded, my lover and adorer, a sacrificer to me. Bow thyself to me. Thus, united with me in the self, thou shalt come to me, having me as your supreme goal. Look at this, my-minded. It means knowledge. My lover and adorer, sacrificer, one who gives through action. So, Jnana Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Karma Yoga, all brought together in one compass in this movement of bhakti. It means the complete connection to the divine in all levels of the being. So we'll put a bookmark there and begin the next paragraph next week. And we'll conclude the way of devotion then. But remembering how this chapter opened, here's a selection from Savitri, which I think you'll find appropriate for the evening. Or the morning, depending on where you are. This is in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 12, The Heavens of the Ideal. And we'll begin on page 278. Pardon me. Let's open the canto instead on page 277. Always the ideal beckon from afar. Awakened by the touch of the unseen, deserting the boundary of things achieved, aspired the strong discoverer, tireless thought, revealing at each step a luminous world. It left known summits for the unknown peaks. Impassioned, it sought the lone, unrealized truth. It longed for the light that knows not death and birth. Each stage of the soul's remote ascent was built into a constant heaven felt always here. At each pace of the journey marvelous, a new degree of wonder and of bliss, a new rung formed in being's mighty stair, a great wide step trembling with jeweled fire, as if a burning spirit quivered there, upholding with his flame the immortal hope, as if a radiant God had given his soul that he might feel the tread of pilgrim feet mounting in haste to the Eternal's house. At either end of each effulgent stair, the heavens of the ideal mind were seen in a blue lucency of dreaming space, like strips of brilliant sky clinging to the moon. On one side glimmered hue on floating hue, a glory of sunrise breaking on the soul, in a tremulous rapture of the heart's insight and the spontaneous bliss that beauty gives, the lovely kingdoms of the deathless rose. Above the spirit cased in mortal sense are superconscious realms of heavenly peace. Below, the inconscient, sullen, dim abyss. Between, behind our life, the deathless rose. Across the covered air, the spirit breathes, a body of the cosmic beauty and joy unseen, unguessed by the blind, suffering world. Climbing from nature's deep, surrendered heart, it blooms forever at the feet of God, fed by life's sacrificial mysteries. Here, too, its bud is born in human breasts. Then, by a touch, a presence, or a voice, The world is turned into a temple ground, and all discloses the unknown beloved. In an outburst of heavenly joy and ease, life yields to the divinity within and gives the rapture offering of its all, and the soul opens to felicity. A bliss is felt that never can wholly cease. A sudden mystery of secret grace flowers, goldening our earth of red desire. All the high gods who hid their visages from the soiled, passionate ritual of our hopes reveal their names and their undying powers. A fiery stillness wakes the slumbering cells, a passion of the flesh becoming spirit, and marvelously is fulfilled at last the miracle for which our life was made. A flame in a white voiceless cupola is seen, and faces of immortal light, the radiant limbs that know not birth and death, the breasts that suckle the firstborn of the sun, the wings that crowd thought's ardent silences, the eyes that look into spiritual space. Our hidden centers of celestial force open like flowers to a heavenly atmosphere. Mind pauses, thrilled with the supernal ray, and even this transient body then can feel ideal love and flawless happiness and laughter of the heart's sweetness and delight, freed from the rude and tragic hold of time and beauty and the rhythmic feet of the hours. This in high realms touches immortal kind. What here is in the bud has blossomed there. There is the secrecy of the house of flame, the blaze of godlike thought and golden bliss, the rapt idealism of heavenly sense. There are the wonderful voices, the sun laugh, a gurgling eddy and rivers of God's joy, and the mysteried vineyards of the gold moon wine, all the fire and sweetness of which hardly here a brilliant shadow visits mortal life. Although are witnessed there the joys of time, pressed on the bosom the immortal's touch is felt. Heard are the flutings of the infinite. Here upon earth are early awakenings, moments that tremble in an air divine. And grown upon the yearning of her soil, time's sunflowers gaze at gold eternity. There are the imperishable beatitudes. A million lotuses swaying on one stem, world after colored and ecstatic world, climbs toward some far unseen epiphany. We can save lines for next week, can we not? Namaste.